Hey guys, it's Sam Guzman here from The Catholic Gentleman, here to welcome you to the very first episode of The Catholic Gentleman podcast. Can't wait to embark on this journey with you, and I hope you really enjoy the show. Just a quick note before we begin this episode, brace yourselves, there's going to be some kinks and quirks to work out. I'm still learning the whole art of podcasting, and I have a lot to learn. So bear with me as I fumble around with editing software and things like that. But I am happy to have you listening, and please enjoy the first episode of the Catholic Gentleman podcast launched today, the Feast of the Epiphany 2020. Hello, gentlemen. I am Sam Guzman, your host, and I am joined today by J.J. Wright, Dr. J.J. Wright, who is a musician and composer. Are you a professor, J.J.?
I am technically, yeah, at the University of Notre Dame.
Wonderful, wonderful. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure, yeah. So my background is actually as a jazz pianist, and I grew up in Buffalo, New York, in a big family. I've got six siblings. And I made my way eventually to DC, where I was in the Navy for 4 years, and then to New York City, where I did my undergraduate degree in jazz music, and then ultimately here to Notre Dame, where I did my master's and doctorate, and then now I direct a choir here of undergraduates, about 60 of them, and we're a liturgical choir, so we sing every Sunday in the Basilica of the Sacred Heart here on campus.
That's wonderful. And I've been to Notre Dame and heard the choir, and it really is fantastic. So great work with that.
Thank you.
And recently I came across your new recording, Vespers for the Immaculate Conception, and this is a piece that you composed, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
And I have to admit that it's kind of unlike any other sacred music that I've heard. It's an amazing blend of styles, all kind of woven together, and styles that you might not think would go together initially, but they work. And it's a very cool thing to experience. You got a little bit of Gregorian chant, a little bit of I don't know, Baroque in there, and then of course jazz. You mentioned you're a jazz pianist. Tell us a little bit about what inspired you to kind of combine all these styles that at first glance might not be something that you would think would go together.
For sure, yeah. So like I said, my background was in jazz, and when I was a younger musician, jazz was everything for me. So I was kind of had all my chips in that basket, I guess. And I got a church job when I was living in New York City, and I'd been playing at Mass kind of since I was a teenager, and playing for different types of things having to do with church. And when I was living in New York, my wife and I had just gotten married, and I got this job kind of purely by coincidence, really. We were really close with this community of religious men in New York City called the Franciscan Friars of the Renewal. And they kind of, there was one of our good friends, Father Sebastian, he was doing like a preaching retreat at a parish, and he called me the next day and he was like, "Hey, these people just happen to be looking for a musician. I don't know if you're looking for a job or not, but I thought of you." And I went in to see the pastor like 2 days later, and he hired me for the job. And so I was kind of coming at it like, you know, as a proficient musician, but not really as a musician who had studied sacred music or studied liturgy or studied theology in any way, just kind of, you know, coming at it from the fact that I was a practicing Catholic and a musician. And once I got into it, I started to realize just like how much I really loved playing for Mass and working in a parish. And when I was looking at graduate schools, I applied for all these schools, and you know, all of them were for a master's in jazz, and then one of them was for sacred music, which was kind of just like, you know, I'll just throw my hat in the ring and see. And, you know, I ended up getting into Notre Dame, and we came out here. And when I was making that transition, we were, you know, we were a young family. I think I was 27, my wife also, and we had two little kids at the time. And I thought that, you know, I was kind of putting that other life behind me, in a sense of playing jazz and doing that thing that I really love to do. So I was kind of sad about it. And in my first semester at Notre Dame, I had a really, really great professor who ended up just becoming a really good mentor also. And she was like, yeah, you play jazz, right? And I was like, yeah, I do. And she said, you know, your project for this semester is going to be to compose a jazz vesper service. And I was like, well, I have no idea how to do that, you know, like that. And she's like, well, I'm going to help you do it. So, you know, we'll just meet every week and we'll kind of work through all the different resources that we need to work through to find a great way to do it. And so that was kind of like my first foray into combining jazz with sacred music. And so kind of fast forwarding to this piece in particular, I had written that one, Vespers. It's called Vespers for the Feast of the Transfiguration. And it's the idea behind that was to create like a participatory jazz Vespers service so people could sing along. It's actually, the whole thing's based on this Sufjan Stevens song called The Transfiguration. And I had started to really get deep into, you know, choral conducting and sacred music that's more in that type of style. And I really wanted to write something that was more formal in a sense. And so with this Vespers for the Immaculate Conception, I was doing some research at the time into Baroque sacred music and trying to just figure out like, what were the best practices? Like, how can I try to learn from this tradition that is so, so deep and so full, and take kind of the best things that people have been doing now for, you know, 1200 years that we have a record of at least, and apply those principles to today. And so kind of from the big picture, like conceptual perspective, that's kind of what I was after with this piece. And so that's why you hear Gregorian chant, you hear these Baroque motets, because I was, for the Baroque motets especially, I was like going to the original source material and creating new versions of these pieces. And in a sense, like putting myself in the shoes of those composers from the 17th century so that I could learn how to kind of be, yeah, really be in their shoes and then take those skills and apply them to the music that I'm creating today.
That's amazing. Yeah. And like I said, it's a fascinating combination, but it really works. And, you know, so is there something significant about Vespers, or is there something significant about why you chose the Feast of the Immaculate Conception? Is it just because it's a, you know, a common form of composing, or is there something, a special reason you chose Vespers?
Yeah, there's a couple things. Firstly, I love Vespers because it's, in some ways, it's kind of short and sweet, and it's a great way to both pray communally and pray individually. It's also ecumenical, so like it's kind of, you know, Christians from all different denominations can pray Vespers together and do pray together. So I like it for that reason also. Yeah, so Vespers also, just so we're making sure we cover our bases, Vespers is like the evening prayer of the church. It's part of the cycle called the Liturgy of the Hours. And, you know, it's a set of prayers that people pray all over the world, Catholics and Christians alike. And for this particular piece, you know, it was funny because I got assigned this date for a concert, December 8th, which is the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. And I was trying to think of what can I do to really kind of do something that's new, do something that's sacred, compose some new music, kind of incorporate these ideas that I had been studying from the Baroque and through Gregorian chant. And I just kind of decided I'm going to create this sort of hybrid service, really a hybrid Vesper service to kind of get into these ideas. And so I'm kind of going along and I'm composing the music and really getting into the texts for the feast and everything. And my wife, so at this point we had three kids, And they were all still pretty young, like 4, 3, and 1, I think. And my wife was pregnant, I think 14 or 15 weeks, and she had a miscarriage. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of crazy. Actually, we were just talking like yesterday, my wife and I, and we remembered that she had to have a DNC for that miscarriage. So she had to go in for like a little, like a surgical procedure. And she had that DNC on All Saints Day of 2014, wow. I think it was. And it was so crazy. I didn't think of this at all, but the CD itself came out on All Saints Day. And I did think it was really cool it was coming out that day because of All Saints, but I had kind of forgotten about the significance of that day for our family also.
Yes.
And I know a lot of people have sort of have gone through miscarriages, and at least for me at that time, I had no conception at all of how to relate to my wife and how to relate with my family about this idea. Like, I knew she was just kind of destroyed and really sad, and it affected her really deeply. And I felt like I was like paralyzed because I just didn't, I couldn't relate, you know? And so this music and this sort of work I was doing of composing, I always see that as one of like the ways that I've truly related with God all through my life. And so, you know, like God has put this desire in my heart to compose and to make music and to, you know, really just kind of glorify God through music. And so when these two, like, you know, when reality kind of came up against what I was working on in my work and in my spiritual life, I was like, it was pretty pretty heavy. And I was kind of thinking, well, you know, I don't really understand what it means to have a devotion to the Blessed Mother myself. You know, like, I know I raised Catholic and we prayed the rosary coming up, but for me personally, it was like, I know this is something I ought to do, but I've never really kind of dug into it and figured out, like, is there something for me here? And so it was kind of like a, like pulling back in a way and like really trying to simplify and see myself really where I was. And like kind of through this work of composing the music, I was trying to really understand what it meant to like have a relationship with Mary through prayer and also figure out a way to allow God to kind of like fill this music up with both, you know, the sort of mysticism of this idea of the Immaculate Conception, but also with what we were going through in a very real way with our family. And so,
yes. So it was a healing process almost to write this music.
Yeah.
Sounds like.
Yeah.
And that kind of leads to my next question is, what was the composing process like? You kind of hinted at it already, but, and then the recording process. I've never recorded anything musically in my life. Mm-hmm. You know, what's that process like? Kind of take us inside, if you will.
Yeah. The composing process is actually like kind of weird in a way. Like if I can't be around people when I'm like in the actual work of composing, because it's kind of like maybe what an actor would do if they were trying to like memorize a monologue or something like that. There's like a ton of prep work, you know. It's like, you know, I assemble all the texts and then I kind of use all these different colors to create parallels all through the texts. And then I kind of decide what the form of the thing is going to be. But after I do all the groundwork like that, it's really like in some ways like Lectio Divina, in the sense that I am just like kind of praying with these texts and reading them and speaking them out loud and whispering them and yelling them and kind of trying to hear them from all these different perspectives so that it can ignite something that like it can ignite inspiration around what it could sound like. So it's kind of weird when you really break it down, but at the same time, it's to me, it's a really life-giving type of thing, because it really connects me to the work in body and mind and soul. And then when you get into the whole process of recording, it's kind of like inviting other people into that same type of process. And so for this one in particular, because it was such a big group, we all kind of converged at Notre Dame for the session. And there's a big, beautiful soundstage in one of our halls here. And we were all on the stage. And, you know, so we essentially did everything live. We would run the pieces or run little chunks of pieces so we could get the best version of them. And that was kind of like the first draft of this album. And as I was living with it for a little while, I kind of realized that this piece really needs to have a choir. And so when I was living in New York City, I did an internship at St. Patrick's Cathedral for about a year with their music department, and have kept in touch and become good friends with their music director there, Jenny Pasquale. And she, I kind of just reached out to her on a whim and said, "Hey, you know, I have this record in the can already, but I would love if your choir would record on it and we could kind of, you know, just beef it up a little bit." And so, and she agreed. So that part, I went to New York and she assembled her choir, and we went to a studio, and that was kind of like an overdub session. So all the music was already done, and then the choir from St. Pat's sang over top of what we already had to make the final product.
That's really cool. Yeah. Did they take to the music right away, or was there kind of some growing pains there?
No, they did. They just crushed it, to be honest. Like they sing so, like, part of being a church choir person on that level is like, you just put anything in front of them and they instantly just like eat it for lunch. You know, they just, this was totally true with this piece. They just really dug in and,
you know, I work in marketing.
Like we weren't like doing take after take of things.
One of the first questions you
doing
ask
it in one take and we were
marketing
just blasting
and,
right through.
Who's your audience?
It was really cool.
And kind of what do they want? You know, and maybe that's a too pragmatic of a question. But looking at this album, you know, what was the audience that you thought, you know, they'll really respond to this? Or did you really just kind of think in broad terms, like, this is for everybody?
Who I imagined the audience to be was, you know, people who are interested in the idea of church music and maybe kind of, disappointed by what might be out there from them what might be out there in terms of like something that can be really edifying for developing their faith. I also think that like just in terms of like the classical music on the CD, like definitely there's more of a classical bent to some of the music. And so I think that people who are more geared towards that stylistic preference would probably be interested in it. But I'm also trying to think of like how like it, like it's really difficult kind of when you're a sacred musician or really when you're kind of doing any work in the church, because we do have this really, really long history to contend with. And within that history, like there's so much stuff that's up for grabs. And especially when it comes to music, I mean, so much of like Western art music is predicated upon the contributions of Catholic sacred music. And so for me, at least in my development, like I really wanted to be able to contend with this stuff and encounter it head on so that I can take on really a lot of what the best things are about our Catholic sacred music tradition.
Yeah. So, you know, I, just speaking of, you know, sacred music, a tradition of that, I have some of my own favorite sacred music composers. I think of, you know, Morten Lauridsen or Ola Yalo. But, you know, it's hard for me to say that sacred music is really a popular genre, and yet you've had some success in that regard. So, you know, I think you said you had a Billboard topping album already. And that's fantastic. And I know there's also some sisters in Missouri that have had some success with sacred music. Yeah. And they've just really blown the doors off of that. And so, you know, you look at the culture and it's, you know, all kinds of popular music that isn't sacred in any way, shape, or form. And yet you're seeing this growing interest in a return to the sacred. People are kind of looking for beauty, and they're hungering for a taste of transcendence. So in your opinion, you're much more involved in the musical scene, if you will, than a lot of us. What do you see as the future of sacred music in America? Is it really something where, okay, we really need to change and adapt and, you know, keep up with the times, or do we really need to return to our roots, or is it somewhere in the middle?
Yeah. I don't think we can adapt to the times without returning to where we came from. You know, there's no context for, like, as a Catholic, and I think even theologically, like, if all we are doing is conforming, like simply conforming to the preferences of the world, we've lost our essence as Catholics. Right. If we're coming from a position where we've come to understand and embody what it means to be Catholic, and then we go out into the world, that's a totally different paradigm. And so I'm not suggesting that that we abandon where we've come from, and I'm also not suggesting that we only sort of regurgitate what's already been said. But I do think that there's a lot of power, and I think that there's a, like you alluded to, there's the need and want for relationship with God is never going to go away for any of us. And, you know, I think as Catholics, that's really the foundation of our own invitation. You know, it's like anytime we can renew that invitation to be in relationship with God and let that be the foundation for the way that we are present in our to ourselves and to our families and in our work and in our communities, I think that that's sort of really living out the baptismal call of what it means to be a Catholic.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the more we answer that call, I mean, there's a lot of people that would say, oh, you know, sacred music, totally outmoded. There's no future there. There's no career there. You know, just give it up. Just do something that, you know, stable. Be an accountant or something practical, mm-hmm. you know? And it's, yeah. And yet there's people like you who are saying, no, you know, this is valuable and we do need to keep this tradition alive. And I think people are starting to respond to that, you know, and no, it's not going to, yeah. you know, you're not going to be at the top of, you know, the charts in, you know, Apple Music or something like that. But right. at the same yeah. time, you know, there are those who are seeking, they're looking for the good and the beautiful and the true, and they're drawn to that when they find it. Mm-hmm. And that kind of leads to my next question. The album came out, as you mentioned, on All Saints Day, which is really cool, and obviously very personal for you. Mm-hmm. But what has the response been already? I mean, is it been positive? Are people intrigued by this? What's the response been?
Yeah, you know, I think it's that we've had some good sort of coverage, and different people have been interested in talking about it. I think that most of what I've observed so far has been just a sort of general curiosity, you know, kind of like, why, you know, why jazz and sacred music? And to me, like, you know, at Notre Dame right now, we're thinking a lot about this idea of pre-evangelization, and sort of encountering a culture that hasn't necessarily been brought up with a Catholic identity in the way that people may have been 20 or 30 years ago. And one of the sort of linchpins for pre-evangelization is this idea of curiosity and building curiosity so that a dialogue can start, and that within that dialogue, we can really invite others to explore this question of what it means to be filled with faith, to be in relationship with God and with Jesus. Like, and so, yeah, I mean, that's kind of, that's exactly the type of response that I hope could happen. I think the other thing that I hope could happen is that we actually have an opportunity to talk about some of the trickier things that families are facing probably a lot more frequently than is let on. Yes. And, and it's kind of funny, you know, I like when you put out an album, like the whole thing is to, you know, you want to build buzz and you want to just get the word around, and then the word gets around and it's like, oh, this is what this is really about. Yes. You know, there, and it's not necessarily something that's happy in the superficial way.
Right.
And so like, I think that that is emblematic also of what our faith asks from us, in that, you know, there's no suffering without joy. There's no joy without suffering. And to really be, I think to find authentic relationship with God, you know, he's constantly asking us to embrace both of those postures. You know, you have the, yes, you have the crucifixion and you have the resurrection separated by a couple days, and that's the model for what it means for us to be Christian, I think.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, you have the resurrection without the cross. It doesn't really make any sense, you know? And yet, right, you have the cross without the resurrection, and it's just despair. And so, mm-hmm, I think, yeah, that's the beauty of the Christian message, is it can combine those two, the joy and the sorrow, and, you know, the rosary, you know, the joyful mysteries and the sorrowful mysteries lead, right, to the glorious mysteries. And I think
that's right.
That's really, really beautiful. And I, you know, the Feast of the Immaculate Conception is such a beautiful reminder of all of those realities are all kind of, the whole salvation history kind of starts there. And so as I think it's beautiful that that's kind of the theme of this album. And also the launch date of this podcast. So it's very providential that those threads came together at the same time. You know, I'm going to ask you in just a second here where people can find the album, where they can listen to it, how they can share it with their friends. But first, I was just going to ask you, so what's next for you? I mean, this is probably a big undertaking, probably a long time in the making. You released it, sigh of relief. What's next, though? Do you have more in the works, or are you just going to kind of take a deep breath and?
No, I'm right in the thick of a new piece, actually. I'm writing a setting of the Passion, actually.
Oh, wonderful.
And I collaborated with a poet to create a script, a libretto, and the purpose really of this Passion is to face head on this clergy sex abuse, wow, crisis that we're all contending with, and, wow, and really to turn our gaze from sort of obsession about the clergy sex abuse crisis to the Passion, and try to understand the sex abuse crisis through the lens of the Passion.
That's amazing.
There's, you know, all of these things that we're talking about every day of betrayal and deception and cover-ups and people turning on each other. And, you know, this stuff is all present in the gospel, and it's all present sort of in that sacred moment of what we celebrate during the Paschal Triduum. Like when Jesus is betrayed by his friends, they all leave, and he's murdered unjustly for telling the truth. And I think that there's a lot of richness that we can uncover in the face of real sorrow and real corruption among some of these people who have been convicted, and try to find a way forward through this. You know, ultimately, like, if we don't face it head on, this, it'll just continue to create a certain rot that, you know, and there's nothing less inspiring than that type of posture when you're faced with something that's difficult.
Absolutely. I've often thought that the exact same thing that you just articulated, where, you know, if we just stick our heads in the sand, it's not happening, don't think about it, don't, like, you know, that's not where redemption happens. You can't redeem, you know, suffering and evil when you ignore it. And as we were just saying about, you know, the Passion of Christ, you know, he confronted evil head on and entered into that suffering and, you know, came out the other side. And all the suffering of humanity, you know, redeemed in that moment. And so, yeah, we have to face the darkness. And, you know, I heard a quote from St. Francis one time. I don't know if he actually said it or not, but it's still a beautiful quote. Is that, mm-hmm, all the darkness in the world cannot overcome the light of a single candle. And I just think of, you know, during the Easter Vigil, when you process in with the Paschal candle, and there's, you know, that light in the darkness.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I'm very excited about that. Will it be a similar blend of styles or?
Yeah, I think so. The really kind of exciting and challenging part is that this piece will involve a children's choir and an adult choir.
Oh wow!
And so we're kind of really inviting a full spectrum of the faithful into the conversation, and not just saying like, you know, this conversation is for adults only, really. Like, you know, there's nothing sort of inappropriate in the piece, but at the same time, I think that we really, you know, I direct a children's choir here on campus, also kids who are 11 to 14, and we're working hard with their parents to really, you know, try to see like what is the best way to talk about this? Like, is this something you want your kids to be a part of? Or because most people in the choir are Catholic, and so we're kind of just like we're facing it as our own community, and we're trying to really work together and see like, how can we, as our own little community, and as far as we can control, like address this through the passion and through art. And so that's kind of the way it's shaping up so far.
That's fantastic. I'm quite excited about that. So I'll keep my ear to the ground for more news on that. Where can people find the album and listen to it?
Yeah, so the best way to get it is from Ignatius Press. Their website's ignatius.com, and search for Vespers for the Immaculate Conception, or you can go to my website, which is jjwrightmusic.com. It's WRIGHT. It's also available, of course, on all of the streaming sites, Spotify and Apple Music and Amazon. It's kind of out there everywhere now, so... I appreciate anyone's support who's looking to listen.
Excellent. Well, I certainly enjoy the album. Just a true experience of human creativity and beauty, and just a wonderfully unique listening experience. And I very much enjoyed it. So I encourage everybody who's listening to this, get a copy. I think you'll love it. And again, it's kind of unlike anything you've heard before. But incredibly beautiful celebration of Our Lady's Immaculate Conception. So thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Wright. It's been wonderful having you.
I appreciate it, Sam. Thank you.